probably can't really go without a day about hearing how we need protein. Protein isn't just a fitness buzzword, it's the foundation of our food future. As our population surges past 8 billion people, we're really facing a critical question. How do we feed everyone without destroying the planet in the process? Traditional protein production is staggeringly inefficient. You need acres of land, massive water consumption, and significant emissions. And all of this for a single serving of animal protein. But what if there was a way to create complete protein just using 1% of the land while producing only 3% of the emissions compared to beef? That's exactly what the Protein Brewery has accomplished, not with fields or farms, but with fermentation tanks.
It is a whole food superfood, so that's how we also position it. So it's 50% of complete protein. And what we mean with complete protein is that's the same amino acid profile as, for example, whey protein. So very, very comparable to proteins from milk.
So in this episode, I sit down with Taj Bosch, CEO of the Protein Brewery, who joined the company just 5 months ago while in the middle of their 30 million euro raise. He breaks down how they're scaling a revolutionary protein ingredient that delivers on nutrition without the environmental trade-offs. From fermenting fungal strains to navigating complex world of food tech fundraising, this conversation reveals what it takes to build a better protein system from the ground up.
We definitely don't position ourselves as a cheap ingredient, because of the value that fermenting can bring. And I think on the upside, like obviously we don't have an enormous amount of capacity that we have to market or that we have to sell. We want to scale that quickly, but we need to be working with the right type of customers in there.
Welcome to the Capitalist Hippie, the podcast where we challenge the old rules of business to build something better. I'm Marco Pimentel, marketing expert, entrepreneur, and lover of bold, sustainable ideas. Every week, we dive into data-backed insights, groundbreaking ideas, and real-world strategies that help you outthink and outmaneuver the status quo. Now, this isn't just another meat alternative. It's a complete reimagining of how we produce nutrition at scale. From sports supplements to functional foods, the Protein Brewery is positioning itself not as a replacement, but as something fundamentally better. Let's dive into what happens when brewing meets biology and how scaling sustainable protein might just help us feed the future. Thank you, Taj, for joining me. Excited to dive in with you today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you joined recently to become CEO. What attracted you to the Protein Brewery?
Yeah, so I joined in June, so now approximately 5 months in the new role. And I knew about the Protein Brewery because I was before this job, I was working for Kozun, which happens to be in the same city as where the Protein Brewery is based. And also at that company, we looked into fermentation and into fungal strains, etc. So I knew about the company, and when they approached me to talk about the job as CEO, I already had some background information, and I'm super excited about the technology and also about the prospect to really work for a sustainable technology and make an impact through that.
So for people a little bit, or people, anybody that's unfamiliar with it, can you maybe describe just like what the Protein Brewery is? Like what's its kind of core technology and maybe a little bit of the sustainability context as well?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, the Protein Brewery was founded in 2020 by Wim de Laat. So he started that business about 5 years ago. And that's also when they raised the Series A with the existing investors, about 22 million raised they did. And it's a company that has developed a novel strain from mycelium, so a fungal strain. And through a biomass fermentation process, we basically brew a mycelium powder. So we have very large 80,000 liter tanks where we basically grow the organism and then ultimately we make it into a powder, which is about 50% protein and then 35% fiber. So it's really a combination of a protein and a fiber in one. And we use that for a large variety of food applications.
And I'm guessing the name Protein Brewery, is that just the fact that you're brewing this? Does it look like a like a what people would think from a beer side of things?
No, exactly. Yeah, I think if you're familiar with beer brewing and the beer brewing process, which in the end is also a fermentation process, that's how the name was indeed developed. And technically speaking, it should be the protein and fiber brewery, but I think that's a bit too long. So that's why they ended up with the protein brewery. But that's correct. Yeah, it's a fermentation process. It's, to your earlier question, it's a very sustainable way of producing food. So far smaller amount of CO2 output. It requires very little land, very little water. So a very sustainable way of creating high quality nutrition.
Yeah. And you're based in Amsterdam. So I'm based in North America, and protein is Starbucks now has a protein foam on top of your drink. So like protein is just everywhere. You have to have it. How much you have it, it's everywhere. So what's the actual product? You mentioned it's a protein type of powder, obviously packed with fiber. How do you use that? Is it meant to replace the protein drink market? Is it meant to be an ingredient that's used for food companies? And how does the product actually end up getting used?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's it is a whole food superfood, so that's how we also position it. So it's 50% of complete protein, and what we mean with complete protein is that's the same amino acid profile as, for example, whey protein. So very, very comparable to proteins from milk. It has 35% prebiotic fiber, so very good for gut health and for the metabolism. It is full of vitamins, minerals, and a couple of what we think super interesting bioactive ingredients in the material. So what we do, we actually leave the biomass intact. So we don't fractionate it, we don't ultra process it. We really, we pride ourselves on quite a minimal processed product.
Okay, so what stands out to me here is how innovation sometimes looks like restraint. In an industry obsessed with engineering nutrition, leaving the food closer to its original form might actually be the smartest business move. Because the more transparent we are about the process, the stronger the consumer trust. And trust is the currency of modern food brands.
And ultimately, we create a powder out of it. So it looks like a bit of a pale powder, which you can use indeed into, for example, sport nutrition products. You can make dairy alternatives out of it. So, for example, a non-animal yogurt. But also, we apply it quite a bit into healthier bars, healthier snacking products. But where we now see the most traction, and especially in the US market, is really in the nutritional segment. So into functional supplements, protein powders, things like that. Yeah.
And when it compares to, you mentioned whey, so from a nutritional side, it's similar to a whey product, but from a taste or that type of thing, is it kind of similar as well?
Yeah, it is very neutral in taste. So I think that's also one of the benefits from growing a fungal protein powder. It doesn't have that off taste or that beany off notes that a lot of the plant proteins have. And I've been working for about 12 years in the whey protein industry, and then for about 3 years in plant proteins, and now for a short while within mycoproteins or fungal proteins. And I think this is it's a more complex product in a way, because it's a combination of protein and fibers, but it's also an ingredient that has enormous potential.
My wife used to own a hemp business as well. And I remember, 10 years ago, the hemp protein, it was great for you, but it was just so grainy and very, very, and it's similar kind of a bit to the pea proteins as well. They definitely carry a bit more of the kind of the grainy side. And so when you think about your product and you think about the kind of the end user or the audience, ultimately there's a market that people just want protein, then there's a market that people want plant-based protein. How do you approach that? Because I think one of the things about sustainability, especially marketing to sustainability, is that people often don't want to make the choices. They just want something that's healthier, and if it's similar, you're not making a sacrifice to go with a different protein versus, let's say, a good quality whey protein. But you have a lot of market opportunity there, it seems. So how do you try to position it? And we'll get into your sales, how do you do your sales and everything, but how do you think about that product in the market then?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we already identified quite early on is that like sustainability and being animal friendly or plant-based is a bit of a hygiene factor or like a ticket to the table. So it's not really a key differentiator anymore. And it also depends a bit by region in terms of how that is perceived.
This is a sign of a market growing up. When sustainability stops being a differentiator, it means it's finally become a baseline expectation. The real question now is, who can integrate purpose so deeply into their model that it quietly drives performance instead of loudly selling virtue?
So we don't intend to replace animal proteins or plant proteins. We really position it as a whole food ingredient. And I think that's also something that makes Firmatine, which is the ingredient name, what makes it unique is that whole food combination of protein and fiber. It's prebiotic, so it's good for your gut health. It has a complete protein, so it's good for muscle maintenance. It has a very relatively high level of spermidine, which is a very interesting bioactive for cellular health, for longevity nutrition. So yeah, what we're, and one of the complex things of what we do is there are a lot of messages and a lot of benefits in promoting as an ingredient. And therefore it's also more challenging to position. It's relatively easy if you're making a protein isolate that you put into a protein shake because you're just selling a protein. And we're selling a lot of different types of health benefits within one ingredient.
So you just raised 30 million euros. Was that for factory? Was that for scaling? Was that for, is there any approvals that you need in this? What was the money for, and where were you thinking of using that?
Yeah, it is all of the above. So the fundraising process was, of course, already in motion while I joined. So that was also one of the challenging things, that there was like a CEO change in the middle of the fundraising process. But we worked through that really constructively, also with the former CEO. And the money that was raised from both current and also from new investors, it is for indeed scaling the factory. So we need to expand the capacity from where we are now. With basically adding additional fermentation capacity. It's for building the commercial and the application team, so developing new applications with our ingredient and expanding our market reach. And it's indeed also for making sure we get all of the required regulatory approvals. So we have now self-GRAS for the US. We have filed with the FDA, so we expect no further questions letter around Q1 2026. We're waiting now for EFSA approval for Europe, but we obviously also want to go into new markets.
So you're getting prepared to kind of take what you've built now, what you've proven, into the market to start selling it, or have you started to sell it to customers?
Yeah, we have started to sell it. So we are launching into a ready-to-mix protein product in the US as of next month, actually, as of November. So it will be available on Amazon within the next couple of weeks. And then also with another customer as of January, February. We also have market approval in Singapore. So next week I will be in Singapore, and that's also where we'll be launching into a couple of brands. But it's still fairly small. So what we've done is basically scaling it from the lab into the pilot plant and then now into our, say, semi-commercial factory with a capacity of approximately 500 tons. And the team have done that over the last couple of years. And now we need to scale it beyond that.
So we're going to get into your, when you say customers, because we'll talk about the B2B versus B2C and all that stuff that you have to make decisions around. But want to just talk a little bit around the sustainability side of this, because your product, in terms of percentage numbers, these are and correct me if I'm wrong from my research, but your product, 1% of the land, 3% of the emissions compared to beef, and yields potentially up to 26 times the protein per land unit versus meat. Those are some pretty crazy numbers. Now, this is where sustainability becomes an economic story. When you can grow 26 times the amount of protein on a fraction of that land, you're not really just competing on ethics, you're competing on efficiency. And efficiency has always been the force that reshapes entire markets.
Yeah. They are crazy, and it is actually crazy if you if you think about the animal protein industry, because it's so inefficient from a land use and from a CO2 and methane emission perspective. So if you grow a lot of animal feed on land and you use that to feed cows or pigs, and then you produce meat from that, it's not a super efficient way to produce protein. So especially the protein, the amount of protein you grow on a certain amount of land, that metric is for us, of course, a super relevant one, because we use a sugar stream as feedstock for our organism. So, and that can be several types of sugars or sugar-rich side streams. The organism produces quite a bit of heat by growing basically in the fermenter, so that, and we can regenerate that and we use that heat as well. And we also recycle the water that we use throughout our process. So actually, on a very tiny bit of land, so if you look at our factory in the city of Breda, it's not a very large plot size, we can grow a lot of protein and a lot of fiber with indeed the fraction of the land and the emissions that, compared to animal protein, but also compared to plant protein. So obviously for growing peas and soy and other types of beans, you still need quite a bit of land to grow the protein.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So you've created a product with some very impressive numbers. The health benefits seem really, really great. Why? This must have been a hard decision, or maybe it's still a decision that you're still making. You know, why didn't the protein brewery say, here's our new protein bar, here's our new protein powder, and build an entire kind of direct-to-consumer product versus going the B2B kind of route that you have so far?
We are a B2B ingredients company, and I also think that focus is super important. So we're still a small company, it's 30 people, of which approximately 15 in the factory and throughout the supply chain. So it is a small team. And then if you want to do a B2C proposition with making it a bar or like a ready-to-mix protein product, it will require a lot of resource and also quite a bit of money. And I haven't seen a lot of examples of companies that have done that really well. So do B2C and B2B at the same time in like a scale-up phase. I think further down the road, or if you're a very large company, you might be able to do it. But even then, I think it's difficult.
We have talked about focus on this podcast many times, especially for startups who are kind of navigating what to do. But focus like this is what allows impact businesses to scale responsibly. By supplying the innovators who already have distribution and brand equity, they multiply their influence instead of dividing their resources, which are so scarce, especially when scaling. In climate tech, enabling others to move faster can sometimes be the most powerful form of leadership.
But our place is really in the B2B space and working together with creative and innovative brand owners and contract manufacturers. That's where we can add most value.
Yeah. So what would be what are the type of ideal customers? Are they the protein companies that want to add an alternative solution? Is it the small bakery that wants to create their own, line of X in the store? Or are you thinking right now likely a little bit of a larger type of customer?
It typically starts when you launch a new ingredient into a new formulation or into a new product. It's quite helpful to work with more agile and a little bit more nimble customers. So not necessarily very small, but ones that are, for myself, the most important metric is what are the amount of new SKUs or new products that are launching and new formulations that are making, because we need to be typically in new formulations rather than replacing or reformulating an existing one, which is typically relatively difficult. So more innovative companies that have, for example, a direct to consumer model, so they can test it out with their customers really quickly, either through Amazon or through their own web shop. And it needs to be in the premium segment. So really focusing on the health benefits. We do not have we definitely don't position ourselves as a cheap ingredient because of the value that fermenting can bring. So it is quite specific what we're looking for in terms of customers. And I think on the upside, obviously we don't have an enormous amount of capacity that we have to market or that we have to sell. We want to scale that quickly. But we need to be working with the right type of customers in that.
Yeah, so like when you start to get these into the hands, and you mentioned that there's a company that's going to be doing a product launch in the U.S. Like, what are the key things that you as a customer, I guess, like as an owner to that customer, are looking for? Like, are you looking to understand like how was it to use our ingredient, and then you're really looking on kind of customer feedback around like how did the product taste, you know, how did it make us feel? Like, is that what you're looking for now, or do you have some of that kind of ready testing and research done?
Yeah, we do that testing obviously ourselves, and also into smaller panels, but we're looking at it from two different ends. So taste, texture and how and mouthfeel are super critical in any type of segment that we play in. So the product has to taste good, otherwise typically consumers won't buy it a second time. And then also the efficacy of the product, so how well does it do the job that you want it to do, whether it's muscle maintenance or whether it's gut health, or whether it's some of the other health benefits that I mentioned around, for example, cellular health. Does it do the job and does it work for you as a consumer? And typically that you don't get the immediate feedback after consuming such a product for 1 day or 2 days. You need to do it for like a longer period of time. That is also the reason why we're doing quite a bit of preclinical and clinical research to watch our ingredients. So how digestible is it as a protein? What does it do as a prebiotic fiber for gut health? Because ultimately we need to be able to justify those health claims, and we need to monitor the efficacy of our ingredient.
So how do you sell this then to those kind of customers? Like, what's your, you know, if you've chosen to go to the B2B route, is this kind of trade shows, lots of phone calls, lots of emails, getting out there, doing press? Like, how do you, you know, as a pretty young, you know, still pretty young startup here, raising obviously Series B, so you've gotten some kind of scale up traction to do that. But how do you build up that sales function and that marketing function as a business?
Great question, and one of the challenges that we have is that we're considered a novel food in quite a few markets. So obviously we cannot yet sell our ingredient in Europe, and we're a European company, so we're quite dependent on both the US market and then the market in Singapore, which is small but a good test market for us. So our primary focus is on the US. So yeah, part of my team was at SupplySide Global this week. I will be in Singapore next week, so we're on the road quite a bit. We have to showcase our ingredient at the relevant trade shows. So, for example, in the Sports and Active Nutrition Summit in San Diego in February, we will be there with a booth. So, yeah, it's getting the ingredient in front of potential customers and showing and showcasing how it tastes, how it looks like, doing pitches, things like that, and doing more media also. And after the Series B, we did quite a bit. That really helps, because then people are aware of a fermented protein. What is a mycoprotein exactly? So it's all new. So you need to be able to explain it.
Yeah, and when you took your and when you do the Series B, or any kind of future money or any future investments, like, is one of the kind of key strategies to find an investor that would be also potentially a customer, to be able to get that kind of type of feedback loop?
Yeah, that's definitely an option. We don't have that at the moment. So our investors are, the primary investor is Novo Holdings. So the mother company or the holding company behind Novo Nordisk and Novo Nesis, a couple of more venture capital related companies. But a larger company that would also want to use it in their own end products, that's definitely an option. Or a company that where we could partner with on the manufacturing side. So yeah, that's like really that strategic relationship will be important for us.
Yeah, obviously where you are and where you're located or where you can actually sell it is a challenge. Thinking about just kind of legacy food systems and legacy food challenges, what's been kind of the hardest thing? You know, you've been in the protein market in the whey market, so you kind of get to see that, but with the protein brewery, what's been kind of that hardest challenge that's been, you know, forced based on the legacy food system, or has there been any kind of really hard challenges there?
Yeah, I think it's a super hard challenge in any type of scale up of a new technology or a new food technology that you're fighting against the incumbents that have been around for decades, are very well capitalized, typically very heavily subsidized as well, especially in the animal protein industry, have large scale factories, proven technologies. So, and therefore a very low cost price. And if you come in with like a new ingredient through a new technology, to get that to scale takes time. So as I mentioned, like we went from 10 liter fermentation, then to 300 liter fermentation in the pilot plant. And now we do 80,000 liter fermentation and we have three fermenters, but we need to go to a bigger scale. Mm. And every time we do a bigger manufacturing step, you need to adjust your processes. It costs time, money, resources, and we're still a relatively small company. So, and the competition that you're up to are all those like larger multinationals that have been around for a very long time. So that is the largest, the biggest challenge, I think. How do you scale it from where we are now and producing hundreds of tons to thousands of tons, and thereby getting your cost price down? And getting enough market traction along the way, and that with a relatively tight runway. I think that's the main challenge.
Yeah, and you brought up the idea that, you know, price point. So when you're smaller and you're going up against the kind of the competitors, what you're doing initially seems that you're selling on the benefits, right? You know, there's obviously the sustainability benefit. It uses a lot less of an impact. It's plant-based. The health benefits, the gut benefits, the fiber benefits. You got lots of benefits, but that comes with a price point that's higher. Is that the ultimate goal with scale? Is that all those benefits kind of win you some early testing, win you some early customers, and then as you scale, the price point goes down to be able to match? Or is a product, just thinking about like your the benefit of your land and how much you can produce based on where you are, like, Is there a scale here in the future that price points kind of the same?
Ultimately, when we do the calculations at a full scale factory, and then you're talking about like 10,000 tons of protein powder output, we will be very cost competitive compared to, for example, whey protein or other types of plant proteins. But it will obviously take a while before we're there and before you've built such a factory. And that will also enable us to go into different types of markets. So if you're talking about like dairy alternatives or baked goods or better for you breads, things like that, typically they are more commoditized, more competitive. And then they might value some of the benefits that we're providing, but not all of them.
Every transformative industry goes through this phase: high costs, low scale, and a belief gap in between. But once production scales, prices drop and adoption typically accelerates. The lesson here for investors and for founders is patience. Sustainability compounds, but only if you give it the runway to mature.
So yeah, for the coming years, I think our sweet spot is really in like the active nutrition type industry, functional supplements. That's where our ingredient can really add value, but also, for example, whole meal replacers, because it's a very clean label solution, given it has all those components into one ingredient. But over time, definitely like bringing the cost down and being competitive over time, it is the only way, I think, to build a business at scale. It needs to be affordable as well.
Yeah, and I'm assuming going after the kind of the active market allows those partners to kind of price point that works, because the active market obviously spent, like, I'm wearing a Whoop that costs like $500 to track my health. So like, you know, I think people are going to spend a little, they're going to spend more money on things that are better for them. And they happen to be better for sustainability and their planet reasons, which is obviously a huge benefit. And, you know, I'm assuming the protein markets and the forecasts are still the growth there is still incredible, is my guess.
It is. If you just look at the wider sports and active nutrition market, it's about a $30 billion market, of which like over 60% to 70% is in the US. So like the US is really the main driver and still growing fast. And like one of the benefits, of course, also for new entrants like us into the market and developing alternative technologies, is that like whey prices and protein prices are relatively high because of like supply constraints. The amount of additional whey manufacturing facilities, for example, is really slowing down. And you see it actually across the board, whether it's prices for eggs, prices of beef, like all those prices are increasing. And because those type of like animal-based proteins are more expensive and way less sustainable, Yeah, we definitely have an inroad into the market.
And so with this money, like, you know, we talk about runways and we talk about what you're doing. What's the ultimate kind of goal for kind of getting Series B to C? Like, what's the check marks that you're trying to achieve?
Well, it's basically two different things. So we need to make sure that we sell as much as we can and that we produce as much as we can within the current facility that we have in the Netherlands. So that's the plan for, say, the coming 2 years, getting to full capacity, developing like lots of interesting and innovative customers with our ingredient. And then at the same time and in parallel, we're also looking at like potential partners that could be both in North America and in Europe, where we can scale our production already faster. So other ways that we can do, it could be, for example, contract manufacturing, but it could also be at our current site in Breda, where we can speed up the manufacturing process, improve yields, things like that. Because also, as I mentioned, the company was founded in 2020, so it's been developed and the factory has been built in a relatively short amount of time. But the technology itself and also the cost effectiveness of it when it comes to things like yields, etc., is not fully optimized yet. So there's still room to grow and improve there. And that's also where we'll be focusing quite a bit of attention on. And a Series C or a next phase of funding will really be the next scale up of promoting in like a different type of facility, which needs to be a lot bigger than what we have now.
And in order to do that, like, are there milestones, like you need to have X amount of future orders typically? Or I guess that helps, I'm assuming, to get those funding rounds.
Absolutely. I mean, the fundraising environment at the moment and over the last couple of years has been pretty harsh. So any type of VC or investor we talk to wants to see commercial traction and wants to see offtake agreements and wants to see like stable and robust technology. Because they're not just investing in an idea, and especially not even a scale-up as the Protein Brewery is considered later stage, because we already have a factory and we're already selling. So for us, those type of milestones and ensuring that we have more demand than supply is absolutely crucial in what we do.
Well, and you know, you mentioned the difficulties, and obviously I get to interview also lots of folks similar to yourself that are in climate focused businesses, that fundraising has been a bit harder over the last couple of years, especially in North America with all the changes politically and everything like that. And so, you know, and then you layer in AI and all the money kind of going towards that, it makes the funding a little bit harder. But at the same time, you know, there's all these amazing, you know, executives and entrepreneurs like yourself that are balancing. They know that we need to make these changes and are still pushing these out there because they're better businesses. And it seems like you've already kind of positioned around that. Like, you've already kind of pivoted from, like, you know, this is a meat alternative product to, like, this is just a better product, right? It's a better for you product. It's going to, and that's how I feel, or maybe the question for you is, you know, do you feel like that's the way the future is going to have to be to kind of position climate? It's more of the this is a better for you product. The decision doesn't need to be as hard of a one, or maybe as drastic a one. Maybe we're asking too much of consumers. I don't know.
Well, it's a good point, and that's like, for example, in the Netherlands, but also in some other European countries, there has been a lot of development, for example, around blended meats or hybrid meat products, because it's just easier for consumers to make a step to a product that's like 60% meat and then 40% pea or lentils or whatever, and it has the same taste, it's a little bit cheaper, and a little bit more sustainable. It's more appealing than like what I would consider a meat replacement product that doesn't really hit the right taste buttons. But for the Protein Brewery, the decision was made relatively early on that there would not be a focus on a meat alternative product, because there are plenty of other microprotein producers who do that at a larger scale and that probably started a bit earlier with that. I think in hindsight that has definitely been the right choice, and now we continue on that pathway by indeed creating a better for you ingredient that's more sustainable, that's whole food, because I think that focus on more minimal processed ingredients rather than like ultra processed or trying to fractionate every type of ingredient is going to be very important if you want to have a clean label on your product.
The product that you mentioned that's going to be selling on Amazon, is that something that you can name, or is that something that's still internal?
No, we can. I can definitely name it. Like it's a product is called Micell Pro, and it will be available on Amazon mid-November. So it's like a whole food protein product that will be available. And it's really targeting like the benefit areas that I talked about gut health and muscle maintenance. So I'm really excited to see that launch. And there will be more launches after that, obviously as well.
Any words of advice for any entrepreneurs or executives that are balancing that kind of fundraise that, you know, you guys closed 5 months ago and that you joined kind of halfway through to kind of finish? Like, what would be the advice that you'd give them?
I think it's about being persistent, consistent, and transparent. So transparency around it takes quite a bit of time to scale like a new ingredient, and especially in the food tech space, like it doesn't happen overnight. So you need to be clear about that to your investors as well, and being consistent also in your messaging in terms of your go to market strategy is also important. And for us, and I think that's quite a nice balance by having like a more strategic investor on board with the likes of Novo Holdings that looks into the fermentation space and it looks into GLP-1, combination of venture capital money. But now we also have more state finance funding through InvestNL and a regional development agency of Brabant that are like it's a little bit more patient capital. So they do it to make impact in the region, and they want to finance like first of a kind factories and things like that. That combination is for us has been a really good one, so that you don't focus just on one single type of investor set or just venture capital or just like corporate venture capital. But really that mix has been very, very beneficial. And then maybe the last part is around choosing your board wisely, so the people that are on your board, if you have one, that they can really add value, especially when it comes to manufacturing and go to market, and that is really something that's really helping us at the moment as well.
The Protein Brewery isn't just another alt protein startup. They're really redesigning the economics of nutrition with a process that delivers complete protein and fiber using a fraction of the resources. They're proving that sustainability isn't a sacrifice, it's really a smart business. What stands out from my conversation with Taj is how they position themselves not as like a compromise for the sake of the planet, but as a superior product that just happens to use 99% less land than conventional protein. It's a masterclass in how climate-focused businesses can win on performance first. As Taj put it, persistence, consistency and transparency are what it takes to scale a revolutionary food technology, especially when you're challenging a heavily subsidized incumbent industry. Thanks again for listening to The Capitalist Hippie. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who's thinking differently about our food system, and I will talk to you on the next episode.